And welcome to Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Victor Agreta. My guests today are Gerald Green with the Metropolitan Planning Commission, the executive director, actually, of the Metropolitan Planning Commission, and Scott Barker, co-founder and reporter for Compass Knoxville. We are going to be talking about RECODE, which is, of course, a massive overhaul of the codes around town here. And we're going to get to that in just a minute. I want to actually start with you, Mr. Green, and give people a little bit of a sense of background. How long have you been with the MPC, and what did you do before you came to Knoxville?
I've been with MPC 3.5 years. Before coming to Knoxville, my first visit to Knoxville was when I was in graduate school at the School of Planning here at UT. Then I left Tennessee, went to North Carolina. I was planning director for Brevard in Transylvania County, a smaller community southwest of Asheville, then went to Asheville and started as a senior planner, I believe, and worked my way up to chief planner for the city of Asheville. I was with the city for 15 years. Then I had a planning and design firm for about 10 years, providing services for public and private clients.
Excellent. And I want to get some basic terminology out of the way so that folks understand kind of like how all of these pieces fit together, because this is sort of a jigsaw puzzle in many ways. Tell me, what is the normal role of the Metropolitan Planning Commission? I mean, what exactly do you guys do?
Okay. First, I'm going to start with some news on the part of the Metropolitan Planning Commission. We have rebranded to be known as Knoxville, Knox County Planning, because our core mission is planning for the future growth and development of the city and county while maintaining those assets and icons that are important to the community, from our built resources of our neighborhoods to the natural resources, protecting the rivers, the ridges, and basically taking comments from all directions and trying to coalesce them into a unified vision for the city. We do long-range plans, the sector plans, corridor plans, community plans to basically identify that vision for the future. Then we develop zoning codes, subdivision regulations to implement that vision. We provide staff to the Planning Commission, City Council, and County Commission, as well as assistance to the Board of Zoning Appeals of both the city and county. We also provide staff to and administer the historic zoning for those designated historic districts and properties. We provide staff assistance and administration for the Tennessee Technology Corridor. We provide staff assistance for the Infill Housing Committee and for the Downtown Design Review Board. We also provide addressing and street naming for the city and county, and do transportation planning, long-range transportation planning, not only for the city of Knoxville and Knox County, but also for the town of Farragut and outlying areas within our transportation planning area, which include Sevierville, parts of Sevier County, Maryville, Alcoa, parts of Blount County, and Oak Ridge, which includes parts of Roane County and Anderson County.
Excellent. All right. Now, I also want to give people an idea of sort of the scope of what we're talking about and one of the reasons why RECODE is necessary, other than the fact that it's been over 50 since we've had a major overhaul. Scott, I want to turn to you. What does the population growth in Knoxville look like in the past 18 years?
Well, Knox County has grown quite a bit over the past couple of decades. What has shifted is the city of Knoxville's portion of that growth. Up until 2010, the city of Knoxville's portion of the population growth was fairly low. And since then, and Gerald might actually have better numbers than I do off the top of my head, that proportion has grown up to between 25% and 30% of the population growth in Knox County is actually occurring inside the city of Knoxville.
Oh, wow.
And that's correct. Between 2000 and 2010, the city of Knoxville accounted for about 9% of the county's growth. And between 2010 and 2017, the city was able to capture almost 30% of the county's growth. So that's quite an upswing.
In terms of numbers, what does that translate into? I've got friends in Austin and Nashville who talk about like 100 people are moving here a day. So, I mean, what sort of numbers can people visualize in that term?
Not 100.
Not that many.
trying to the projections differ, and they're always changing based on conditions. And I think now our projection to 2040 is somewhere between now and 2040, which is approximately 20 years, the county is projected to grow about 120,000 So divide 120,000 by 20, and you get 6,000 people a year. 30% of that would be about 1,800 within the city per year.
Wow.
But that's given our current population, and that's a reasonable number for the city. That is good. That we can accommodate that growth, but we do have to change our development standards in order to accommodate it in a way that doesn't stress the city and strain our resources, and also result in implications that may adversely impact our communities.
And especially down the road, you guys think sort of really long term.
Yes.
And speaking of that long term, Scott, we've been saying codes haven't changed in over 50 years. I mean, first of all, why is that? And have there been any changes in that time? Obviously, there are things that happen. It's not just been stasis in that entire time.
Right. I think the best way to look at the major part of the zoning code is to look at it as a framework. And 50 years plus ago, the framework was the traditional suburban automobile-centric model that was that emerged in the post-war era. And things change. The framework stays the same, but things change with land, different land uses, zoning, rezonings for specific businesses or for residential neighborhoods and things like that, or subdivision development, things like that. So it always changes, over time. But that framework has essentially been the same. And what RECODE is, I think, I mean, as an outsider, is building a new framework for future development, and as you mentioned, MPC looks at things long term, and one of the things you have to realize is that this is something that we're going to, the basic framework we're going to be living with for the next 20, 30, 40, maybe even 50 years.
And Mr. Green, I think there's maybe some confusion also with people when they hear like ordinances and zoning and this kind of thing, because when I posted about this on my own social media, a friend of mine said, well, they need to rezone Cherry Street. I mean, I don't know that that's really what we're talking about here. We're talking about the overall framework, whereas the individual zoning on a case-by-case basis, that's something that is ongoing, right? That's something that changes over time, definitely.
Yes, yes, and no.
Okay.
And it's on an individual parcel basis, we typically deal with those on a request basis. Mm-hmm. The applicant requests a rezoning, a zoning change from residential to some form of commercial. And within the RECODE of the update of the zoning ordinance, we are changing the designation of the zoning districts. For example, C3 commercial typically becomes general commercial. We're not trying to change the overall lines, in that if a property is residential, it will remain residential. The standards under which development occurs within that residential area may change, but the overlying designation will not change in most cases.
Okay. And Scott, are there ordinances you can think of that have been challenged in recent years?
There have been fights over these ordinances in recent years. The city has an off-street parking ordinance that was mm-hmm. that was controversial, especially the sign ordinance, which is related to zoning.
Mm-hmm.
It was very contentious, and it took a long time to work that out. In a similar fashion, this is taking a long time to work out. And this is probably more important than those ordinances have been, because this affects, 73,000 plus parcels of property in Knoxville. So if you own a piece of property in Knoxville, whether it's commercial or residential, or if you rent in Knoxville, in other words, everybody is affected in one way or another by this process.
Well, and that's what struck me too, of course, is that this is something that everyone interfaces with, but they don't realize it perhaps, right? And that was something interesting as well, was that this is comprehensive. I noticed that at the forum that you guys hosted, someone had asked, well, can we get this in you know, digestible bites? And I think your comment was that this is a interwoven fabric. You know, it's like you can't just pull at threads of it. So explain a little bit, I mean, about how that comprehensiveness affects people on a day-to-day basis.
Well, it affects the use of land at the top level, whether a parcel is residential, commercial, or industrial. So that impacts if the property next door to you is designated as commercial, the development potential is much greater and the impacts of that development are much greater than if it's a large lot, single family. It also impacts traffic, the transportation network. We're trying, and in that vein, we're looking at our corridors. A primary focus of attention is our corridors, Kingston Pike, Chapman Highway, Broadway, Central, Magnolia, and Clinton, and trying to encourage greater density and a greater mix of uses along those so that we can accommodate some of that growth we talked about earlier, but also provide better transportation options, you know, transit, biking, bicycling, and automobile transportation. So it impacts that. How do we accommodate the growth if you're in a neighborhood and we don't allow density along our corridors and mixed uses with residential? Well, that residential growth has to come into your neighborhood. And how does that impact your neighborhood? While we're trying to provide all types of options, we realize that we can't put the focus of development in any one area. We have to look at the city comprehensively overall. Where can we accommodate the growth and how can we do that so that we use the resources we have but not abuse the resources that we treasure here in the county?
Well, that makes sense. Just real quick, though, is this something that we should do every 50 years or is it something that, you know, we should do every 10 years? Is this too long a span that we've gone without
comprehensive? I think it's too long a span when we look at some of the development trends we've had, and I'll speak to the Broadway Central area. A lot of that development has occurred by variance, which prolongs the process for the developers, makes it more uncertain for the developer and for the community overall, having clear standards. And I have stated at public meetings that after a year, we'll review this and tweak it because we know there will be things that we miss that we're not aware of. And in that first year will be somewhat of a test period for the ordinance, and we'll review it after a year. And then I recommend every 5 years doing a comprehensive update. Changes are coming so quickly, and we think about the impact autonomous vehicles will have on our community. And although some people don't like to think about this, the impact climate change can have on our community, and that Knoxville is very fortunate in its situation with water resources and protected from climate extremes by the mountains. Well, people from the Southwest and Florida and the wherever else be eyeing Knoxville, how will those changes happen? We can't predict, but in 5 years, we'll certainly have a better feel for that.
That makes sense. Well, we'll return in a moment to take your questions via phone and social media. You're listening to Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT. I'm Victor Agreta. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT. I'm Victor Agreta. We are talking about Knoxville's effort to overhaul its zoning ordinances, an effort called RECODE. My guests are Gerald Green with the Metropolitan Planning Commission, which is being renamed, of course, and I can't remember the name right now off the top of my head.
The Knoxville, Knox County Planning.
There we go. It sounds a lot nicer, actually. Scott Barker, co-founder and reporter for Compass Knoxville, who's been covering a lot of RECODE. And we'd like to hear from you. Call us at 974-5050. You can also tweet your question to us at WUOTFM, or you can also ask on our Facebook page. And so moving forward here, I was interested in, are there some examples, you know, I love these things like wacky laws where you can't bathe outdoors or something like that. Are there examples of some old codes that were really out of date that just, you know, you guys said, oh my gosh, we got to do something about this?
To some extent, all of them.
Right? Yeah.
But I'll pick up one. Think of Happy Holler and the development template for Happy Holler, which is buildings close to the street on zero lot lines built right next to each other. Under the current standards, if flats and taps were demolished, the building that had replaced it would have to be set back a minimum of 25 feet from, not from the street, but from the edge of the right-of-way, which could be an additional 10 feet. Yeah. So 35 feet from the street, it would have to be set back from the side properties, basically would look like, you know, your standard suburban fast food operation could go in there. So those, the codes, as Scott alluded to, are not keeping up with the type of development that is occurring and that we want to see in our city. Given our limited land resources, we have to allow a more intense development pattern within the city and to meet the needs of the city without sprawling out more within the city and the county.
And you know what's interesting about that too is that it seems like you're trying to maintain the character of these individual neighborhoods as well.
Yes, and we're, you know, we're one of the somewhat controversial and misunderstood aspects of it. There a group that equated zoning with affordable housing, and zoning cannot address the cost of housing. All we can do is try to manage the opportunity for residential developments. That we were stymieing affordable housing, and they had an effort to bring back the orange. Orange was the color of multifamily zones in the old zoning ordinance. Mm-hmm. And there were stable single-family neighborhoods all over the city, from South Haven to Oakwood, Lincoln Park, to Bell Morris. They're zoned for 25 to 30 units an acre, which is out of character. And those are affordable, stable, single-family neighborhoods. So we can't, you know, we're trying to preserve those neighborhoods because we don't want to overload those neighborhoods and do something out of character. So the new zoning code does propose single-family designations for most of those neighborhoods in keeping with the request of the neighborhood organizations and the people who live in them. So we're working hard to maintain that character.
And speaking of neighborhoods and the character of those neighborhoods, Scott, I'm interested. The real estate market in Knoxville is booming. Seems like every 5 minutes there's another realtor born. So what are realtors looking at when it comes to RECODE?
One thing that the realtors that, of course, we've been working with, we had a forum on RECODE. We partnered with the Knoxville Area Association of Realtors, and they've been very active in this. One of their major concern is flexibility. They want to make sure that, to the extent possible, that property owners have the flexibility to develop their properties in multiple ways, and that kind of property rights is where that's where their launching pad is.
Mm-hmm.
And so they want to make sure that say commercial development, the configuration of the property on the lot, RECODE in many, I would say, instances, as it's drafted now, requires a lot of properties to be built up closer to the street, and they're concerned about parking and mm-hmm. how that's going to work and things like that, and how that's going to work. They had their druthers. It would be just more flexibility.
Right. Well, that makes sense. We actually do have a caller. We've got Michael on the line. Michael, are you there?
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
I have a brief comment and then a question. There's a legitimate dispute about the population growth numbers for RECODE. Nick Villavope has written about it extensively on KnoxTNToday.com. And it's also been reported that since the city can no longer annex land into the city to get more tax dollars, that they want this RECODE to increase the density so they have more tax dollars. I just want to say that zoning is a contract, and for the last 50 years, people have been protected by zoning. RECODE should be put on the ballot so the property owners have a chance to vote on it. I feel this is the opposite of planning. Increasing density of this size will create huge KUB infrastructure costs that everybody's going to have to pay. People have their neighborhoods torn up, and the city could easily meet any future growth by simply rehabbing the abandoned homes we have now. There's really no need for this increased density.
All right, Michael, thank you so much. Okay, so what do you say to that?
I would say that interesting theory. Again, as I stated earlier, what we're looking at is a very reasonable population growth based on past actual growth numbers, that between 2010 and 2017, the city did capture 30% of the county's population growth. And the population projections that were to some extent, misquoted by Mr. Della Volpe, are for the county as a whole. And they come from various sources. And as I stated earlier, they're tweaked about every year. The Baker Center here at UT and the Boyd Center both provide, the Baker Center does a great job of, of population projections. And those appear to be most accurate. And they all project a fairly reasonable population growth for the county. And we're just saying that the city may accommodate, based on the recent trend, 20 to 30% of that growth. And what we are doing is allowing the redevelopment of areas by providing for more intense development along our corridors and mixed use, which would include residential. We're accommodating that redevelopment of those vacant parcels. We're applying in a lot of the neighborhoods for the first time, Oakwood, Lincoln Park, Belmorris, South Haven, other neighborhoods, a single-family designation to protect the character of those neighborhoods. So we're not, I'm not sure where this theory we're pushing stupendous density on the city of Knoxville comes from. As Scott mentioned, we're providing a framework, a template for the development. We're not developing anything. And if this gentleman thinks the cost of upgrading a KUB line, a sewer line along Central is expensive, try extending that sewer line out to East Knox County, which is our other option for accommodating the growth that's projected and the trend that we've seen. So we're actually using our resources much more efficiently and economically by allowing growth along our, the major focus for that density and growth is along our existing corridors where the transportation network is there, transit service is available, the infrastructure, water, sewer, power is there. That may have to be upgraded, but again, the cost of that compared to the cost of extending services to East Knox County along to the village of Corydon is insignificant.
And of course, housing inventory is a tangential. That's not exactly something that's a part of this. We've got another question from Chris in Knoxville talking about Hardin Valley. Chris, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi there. You had a question?
Yeah. I live in Hardin Valley, and you know, over the past few years, I've seen the three schools get built in the last 10 years or so. And what I don't see happening is a plan for our roads. Our roads are still 2-lane country roads, and I don't see any planning happening around making those roads safer. We see a lot of bicycle traffic on these roads, and with all the traffic that is now happening because of the schools, I don't see where we've planned for that traffic. And I just wonder, why is that not the case? Why would we not have roads with bike lanes and sidewalks? And when these developers are putting in all these subdivisions, why wouldn't we have them do the same thing? Put in turn lanes, in their area of their road frontage, why wouldn't we have them put sidewalks and stuff in? But I don't see that kind of thing happening.
All right. Thank you for your question. Go ahead.
Okay. And since that's outside our purview, maybe I'll come back again and talk about growth in the county. But to answer Chris's question, there's actually, you need to go to Knoxville, Knox County, or still KnoxMPC.org website. There is underway now the Hardin Valley Mobility Study that is looking at transportation in Hardin Valley. We're working closely with Knox County Department of Engineering, Public Works, and Tennessee Department of Transportation. There's also a group in Hardin Valley, the Hardin Valley Planning Advocates. I encourage Chris to look at their website. That's really pushing for better planning in terms of requiring developers to do sidewalks. That has been a major battle, and at this point, the Planning Commission will require and new sidewalks with all new subdivisions as of February. That is under challenge by a number of developers, and it will take people like Chris calling their commission member and all the commissioners and the mayor, county mayor's office to advocate for that, because at this point the staff and the Planning Commission have our backs against the wall with trying to advocate for sidewalks or infrastructure improvements as part of the development process. We see the need for it, but there's two sides to every story. And at this point, the developers feel that that's not an infrastructure type that they need to provide.
And
one of the things I'm going to jump in here, it kind of points out the differences between the city and the county. For instance, just last night, city council approved $250,000 to study the sidewalk system inside the city to identify gaps, to prioritize projects, yada, yada. The county, on the other hand, had already approved a sidewalk study. It was actually a little bit more. I think it was $260,000 and some change. And they canceled it. They're going to put that money into sidewalk projects. But as far as a comprehensive planning step, they removed that. And typically, development seems to, at least in my experience covering development over the past 20 years, tends to occur before the infrastructure. The infrastructure has to catch up. And there are examples of places where the infrastructure is in place and then nothing.
Right.
I wouldn't say nothing's happened, but
not as much.
But not as much. And yeah. Rutledge Pike is an example of that. Rutledge Pike is a divided four-lane highway with there are businesses along there, but the growth in northeast Knox County just has not materialized to this point to kind of, I don't know if you want to say to justify the road, but to match the size of the road.
And that's really the struggle, it seems like, is that, you know, in an ideal world, the planning would be perfect. It would be in lockstep with development, and then everyone would get sidewalks when they wanted them and that kind of thing. And I can tell you from personal experience, having seen near where I live, they just put in a stretch of sidewalks. And for anyone who's ever seen that process happen, it's unbelievable, especially to put them in after the fact on a well-traveled road. This was a two-lane road, but very heavily trafficked. And it was a monumental effort for just a very short stretch of sidewalk. So I think people underestimate just how difficult and expensive it is to put those sidewalks in, especially after the fact.
Yeah, what we've estimated is that probably a reasonable cost for putting sidewalks in with development is at the upper end is around $50 a linear foot. To put them in post-development, at the lower end is probably $250 a linear foot. So you know, that's a fivefold increase, taking the upper end on one side and the lower end on the other. So the need to balance that infrastructure development is critical in terms of using our financial resources wisely.
Yeah, one of the issues with sidewalks in particular is that once it's post-development, if the city or the county wants to go in and build a sidewalk, they have to buy the right of way, and that's a huge variable there. That is, that if they do it on the front end, they don't have that. They don't have the developer doesn't. You know, obviously it's the developer's property. The developer can put it in, and you know, there's no additional cost to the taxpayer.
Yeah, we have another caller actually, and I believe he's got a bit of an existential question here. Leland, you're on. What's your question?
Yes, thank you for taking the call. I'm a little concerned about the composition of our program today, in that there really doesn't seem to be anybody on the panel who's talking about what are some of the downsides of recoding. So as an example, we've talked about how we're going to recode. It has been 50 years since it's been upgraded. That's not really true. Every year there's small improvements. So it's sort of like take out 50 years of history, throw it away, then put in this new thing. And there seems to be no acknowledgement. Like one of the things around these codes are the case law is so important. So when you put in a whole new thing like this, it becomes a developer's dream because there's not case law around it. So you end up losing a lot of cases and the case law shapes it. So we really don't know what we're in for. And the other thing, you know, there's an assumption that we're going to have more density to support transit. You've said we don't have the density, so we're going to have the transit. To get the transit numbers, we need density. But then there's also this suggestion that, well, it's not really going to affect neighborhoods. Well, of course it will affect neighborhoods if you want to put more people in there to get the density. And so those are some, you know, if you could kind of talk about that, because I'm not really hearing any of the downsides of this and the real risks that were taken to the destruction of the neighborhoods that have carefully been cobbled together over the last 50 years.
All right, Leland, thank you so much for your question.
I can address some of the objections that people have expressed. One of the things that Gerald, first of all, that Gerald has mentioned is that a lot of the density that they're talking about promoting is along what are commercial corridors, where they would allow mixed-use developments where you'd have retail on the bottom floor of a building and then residential use above those buildings. That's not really allowed in most places now. As far as neighborhoods, one of the big flashpoints has been what are known as accessory dwelling units, and which is a phrase that nobody understands. But it's things like carriage houses and apartments over garages and those types of things.
Like we said, Fonzie in Happy Days, he was living in an accessory.
Fonzie lived in an accessory dwelling unit, yes. And a lot of some neighborhood groups have been very vocal about opposing that. They think that will somehow that it will erode the single family nature of the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I think it may or may not be a legitimate concern. I know that the neighborhood in the city that has the most existing accessory dwelling units is Squoy Hills. I don't think anybody's complaining about property values in Squoy Hills.
But
in neighborhoods where they aren't, where they aren't so prevalent, if they became more prevalent, it could change that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the big concerns that people have had.
And we actually do have one more caller, and I believe she wanted to ask something about affordable housing, even though that's not quite what we're talking about here. I'm interested. Bonnie, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hey. What was your question?
Well, my question is this affordable housing. I've been to several RECODE meetings, and that issue is brought up. And I'm not quite clear on, it sounded to me like Gerald Green said earlier in this interview that affordable housing got tagged onto the RECODE in Knoxville, but that's not actually an issue or part of the plan. So it's not clear.
Okay.
Why affordable housing is being raised as an issue as part of RECODE Knoxville.
Okay. Thank you for your question. And I will go ahead and preface and say that, like, affordable housing is definitely something that's on the city's agenda, and it's something that, you know, obviously Knoxville is concerned about. But in terms of RECODE, how are you interfacing with that?
Okay. And I agree, it is an issue, and it's something that the city is addressing in many ways, and it's a challenge that we face here in this community and nationwide, actually. But zoning, because of its legislative dictates and specific legislation in the state of Tennessee, cannot address the cost of housing. We can't directly address the cost of housing. We're trying to, and it has been brought up as an issue during the RECODE because there are groups who have that as an issue and they want it to be on the forefront of everyone's mind, which is admirable. But the only way zoning can indirectly affect the cost of housing is by providing more opportunities for residential development. And we're trying to do that through, as Scott and I have both said, the greatest emphasis is along our corridors by providing for mixed uses. And Scott said, commercial on the first floor, residential on the bottom. It could be all residential building. We're not requiring buildings to have those mixture of uses. So that greatly increases the opportunity for residential development. I think we've gone probably, I'm trying to remember the exact figures, but something under 60% of the land area of Knoxville designated for residential development to
close to 80% of the land area designated for residential development. So that affects the availability of housing. By having housing available along the corridors where there's transit, that further reduces the cost of housing because you can use transit instead of automobiles. So we're trying to address it indirectly, you know, by designating affordable single-family neighborhoods like Belmorris, Oakwood, Lincoln Park, South Haven, Park Ridge for single-family residential use. They're not will not be prey for developers who and investors who want to build bigger homes or apartments and increase the cost of housing. So again, several ways indirectly, but because of legislative dictates, zoning cannot address directly the cost of housing.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like also if you look at let's look at an extreme situation, San Francisco, okay, and you know, you have a lot of beautiful houses, but there's also a lot of restrictions in terms of, like, they have an inventory problem, mm-hmm. absolutely, and there are a lot of restrictions about building new homes and this kind of thing. So is that the sort of thing that we want to try to avoid? Because we still have land out there that hasn't been developed, unlike San Francisco, where if you look, that's almost every square inch has been covered. But we don't want to run into that situation.
That's correct, and that's why we're trying to increase the opportunity for housing development, residential development in the city.
And it seems like there's been increasing interest in this process as you guys are heading down the home stretch here. Compass reports over 60 public meetings, over 600 comments, and all of this kicked off in early 2017. So what are some of the next steps?
The staff and primarily of the planning department, are hosting workshops. We had one yesterday with the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. We'll have a presentation to the Planning Commission next week. The Stakeholder Advisory Committee has requested another public workshop, and these workshops are all open to the public. They're not public hearings, but they're public meetings, and there's an opportunity for public comment at the end of the discussion. The Stakeholder Advisory Committee has requested at least one more workshop. The City Council has proposed, and although they have not been scheduled yet, probably three workshops or so. So these workshops where different groups involved in the adoption process are focusing in on different aspects and really having a great dialogue among the members of those boards and commissions. The review or consideration of the new zoning ordinance is on MPC's agenda for their meeting next Thursday, the 13th. Whether they'll take action or not is unknown. I won't speculate on that, but that will be another opportunity for that board to review. In terms of the formal adoption process, the Planning Commission has to review and recommend make some recommendation on the ordinance. Then it goes to City Council, where they have public hearings and then would take action to adopt based on the Planning Commission's recommendation or varying from the Planning Commission's recommendation.
And one other variable in all of this, of course, is that we have several new City Council members. And then in November, Charlie Thomas signaled he may leave MPC as he's planning to run for City Council in 2019. So what is the status of his seat right now?
Well,
he's still there.
He's still there.
Okay.
So, you know, there's not a vacancy until he leaves. If he leaves, the interesting thing about the timing of all this, politically, is that the city really wants to finish this before we get deep into next year's election season.
We've got mayor, city council, three city council at large, and one city council seat for next year.
Right, plus the city mayor's office.
Right.
And what they didn't want is for there to be some kind of groundswell of support for delaying it beyond the election to let the new council members and the new mayor weigh in. They wanted to finish the job before the election got so far underway that they almost would have to delay it. So,
and speaking of which, you know, at your forum, what were some of the big issues? We talked about some of the accessory, the housing, and affordable housing. But what were some other issues that were raised?
Well, the One of the main things, I think we've actually kind of covered most of the thing. One of the great things about the way this process has worked out, I think that people should appreciate, is that they've had so many public meetings and they have made changes to the ordinance as they've not just been reacting to people, but they've taken second looks, and some things they've changed and revised as this is going, because they're going on the fourth revision, and many of the public comments have been taken into account, and now they're kind of getting down to some of the nitty gritty stuff that instead of the big picture things. One of the like with accessory dwelling units, one of the originally it was just that they would be allowed with now they had restrictions on size and setbacks and whatnot, but now a further restriction has been added to require that they that the owner of the property lives either in the main residence or the accessory dwelling, which has alleviated a lot of the concerns of a lot of people, not all, but some. And you're getting down to, Gerald mentioned the development on Central in Happy Holler. They also created a new zoning area just for the near North Knoxville area where Emory Place is, where there isn't off-street parking and really no, you can't put in a suburban development there. Right. So they created a zone where you don't have to, mm-hmm. and which addresses a lot of the realtors' issues with, give us flexibility to build different things in different places. So we're getting down to now. It's really the fine details that are being worked out. Most of the big picture things have been worked through. Although it's not clear sailing, believe you me. No, there's going to be a lot of serious debate in the next.
Oh no,
coming
I was
weeks.
Hoping for just no, smooth
rubber stamp.
Peace and harmony breaks out in Knoxville.
That's right.
No, it's not going to happen.
I fear that Knoxville is like most places, that they want progress but don't like change. And another favorite quote is, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
Right. Well, an interesting thing in all of this, too, we've got about 6 minutes left, and so I'm curious about this, because I think that a lot of people did not realize until the flooding happened, until the hurricane hit, that Houston doesn't have this zoning thing. And you may have studied this, yes. And so I'm curious about what is your opinion on that? I mean, that's certainly not feasible, obviously, for Knoxville, but it's interesting that they do that in Houston. What's your take on that?
My take is that if you don't plan for the future and acknowledge obstacles and opportunities, that you end up like Houston in a mess. And that, I don't know who said this, but George Harrison had it in one of his final songs, that if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. And so we need to know where we're going.
Yeah.
And for people think that anyone works for the government and doesn't care about money, but I'm a very staunch fiscal conservative. And if we don't plan for our growth and development, we end up with costs that we can't absorb, whether those are infrastructure costs or costs due to natural disasters or just not doing the right thing. And so we've got to have that. We have to know where we're going so we know what road to take.
And well, and the climate change thing is sort of an interesting aspect, right? Because if you think about drainage capacity, just in that one aspect, mm-hmm. right? So if rainfall increases by a certain amount, suddenly you've got drains that are clogging, you've got overfill, you've got all kinds of, swampy territory that used to be dry beds and that kind of thing. Has that been some of the discussion here? Or is it just sort of in the back of the
not
mind?
Not as much. There have been a few people that have brought up climate change. Primarily it revolves around reducing emissions, like, increasing the use of transit and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. And making neighborhoods more walkable and making, if you, when you go back to the, we want to go back to the commercial corridor density, if people live there and they can walk to work, they don't have to you know, they live in Bearden and they walk to work in Bearden. They don't have to drive anywhere, and so mm-hmm. they reduce emissions. And similar to downtown, where yep. if you live downtown and work downtown, you only drive your car once a week to go to the grocery store, and that's about it. So
it does seem like people enjoy walkable neighborhoods, and so that is that a priority?
That's a priority, and going back to what Scott said, if we make those corridors more dense and more more development, then people in those neighborhoods adjacent to them have more opportunities for employment, for activity, for services, for a number of things that we create what I think are more viable, sustainable neighborhoods, which gets into, you know, the whole sustainability thing, looking at a broader, more comprehensive approach to sustainability, where we're not going here and there and not being any place because we have to be other places all the time, that we're in a sustainable neighborhood and a sustainable city that can weather the impacts of whether it's development or naturally occurring changes in our environment, but we're able to manage those and to weather the storm.
We've got a couple of minutes left, but I do want to ask, can you explain how the historic zoning overlay works?
It's a several-step process, and I'll start somewhat at the beginning and go through, try to do it relatively quickly and make something complex a bit more simple. But a neighborhood that feels that it has historic resources, older homes, an older neighborhood, someone in that neighborhood or the neighborhood organization requests their council member to pursue designation as a historic neighborhood. The council member then goes to city council. City council directs the planning staff to review that and move forward to it with it. First, an architectural study is done, and historic study. Are these homes architecturally significant? Has the architectural character been maintained? That, you know, the homes have not been modernized with metal siding and new roof lines or something. With the public process, with community meetings, then at the end of that report, there's a community meeting. The community support is again elicited in their community meetings during that process. Then that recommendation, let's say the neighborhood is historically viable and has good historic character, goes to the Historic Zoning Commission, a volunteer board made of appointees from the community. They make a recommendation. That goes to the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission then reviews it. Then the City Council would then take steps to approve it. At that point, guidelines to guide the renovation of existing buildings and additions to them and new construction are prepared with community input, a lot of community input, and then those are adopted by the Historic Zoning Commission and serve as the guide for new construction redevelopment in that neighborhood. And each new construction is reviewed by the Historic Zoning Commission at a public meeting. So the community is heavily involved throughout the process.
Excellent. All right. Well, I want to thank our guest, Gerald Green, with the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Planning Commission, or the new Planning Commission, Knoxville.
Knoxville, Knox County Planning.
There we go. And, of course, Scott Barker with Compass Knoxville. Thank you so much. Our producer is Greg Hill. This has been a production of WUOT News. I'm Victor Agretta.